Welcome, everyone, to a Basic Conversation podcast. Today, Father Basic and I will discuss the societal and interpersonal dynamics between women and men, a topic he outlined in a lecture titled Bridging the Gender Divide. Father Basic, it's always good to be alongside you.
Brad, I know you are well prepared for this conversation, so I'm looking forward to it.
Well, we've only been wrestling with the gender issue since the beginning of time.
Yeah, right.
So we'll see what we can add to
the body.
You
and your wonderful wife, Laura, have worked it out quite well.
Yes, and she's helped me bridge a lot of the gender divide.
Yes.
We should have her here.
Yeah, true.
We should have a female voice, now that I think about it.
Yes, right.
First principle, have an inclusive voice, but we'll do the best we can as two males exploring this issue. So the lecture, with all your lectures, Father Basic, you frame it within the Christian context and with the idea that with the human condition, that Christian perspective can give us some guidance and some hope. And the title Bridging, too, you've used that in several of your lectures, and it kind of denotes that we can always get better. And so with that, this idea of how can we make things better as far as understanding between men and women, and that was really the context of your lecture.
Yeah, it's a very sociologically based, that is, we're looking at how it's working in society.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess the summary sort of statement is that we've made progress, but we got a long way to go.
We can always get better.
For sure.
For sure. And you used the composite stories of Lydia and Samson. You use biblical names.
Yes.
When you do the composite. And Lydia, you described and you walked through a narrative of her life, a 1960s woman,
yeah.
Married, children. Stay at home, at least initially, goal of keeping the husband happy. That was one of the main goals. And then also when she did venture off into the workforce after her kids were older, the income disparity, men making more money than her. So you've really laid that, kind of painted that story really well. And one of the things that you said was that you introduced it, the Bible, in some ways that creates a patriarchal, that contributes
yeah.
to that. And the phrase that got to me, the one scripture that always kind of makes me cringe or gets the men and women for us to look at each other was the Ephesians 5.
Yeah.
Women submit, wives submit yourselves to the
yeah.
spouse. And so
yeah.
for 2022, that seems relatively out of touch, and I know there's all kinds of biblical aspects to that, but you raised that during your lecture.
Yeah, I mean, you have to. I'm trying to look in all these lectures at what the Christian perspective can
yep.
help us with, and when we bring that in, we have to realize that the scriptures themselves are all written by men.
For men.
All 73 books, and all written by people living in a patriarchal society.
Yep.
So we start out with a sort of disadvantage and the need to try to find within the biblical tradition liberating themes, ideas that would help us to deal with the gender divide. I think we should keep in mind that gender divide is it runs deep. And just take the government thing. What do we got? About 20% of women who are in Congress. 20% of women or less who are CEOs.
Right.
You know, so you got all kind of built-in problems. Now you could say, well, we made progress. Well, it was back only in 1930 that the women got the right to vote.
Mm-hmm.
So you could say, well, they couldn't vote in 1930, and now they've got 20% of Congress. That's pretty good, but also it tells us we got a long ways to go.
Right.
And in the business world, the same way. Fortune 500 companies, I think one of the last times I checked, there was 30 some CEOs women. So we got problems that way. So I think in looking at the problem, One of the things that strikes me is the progress we've made. Title IX, you're a former basketball player. I'm a big sports fan. And when I was in high school, there were no sports for women.
Right.
None. I mean, think of it. And now look at the progress women have made in the world of sports. There's now as many Olympic Games opportunities for women's events as men. You know, and our women's soccer teams have been very successful.
Yeah.
So it's just important to keep in mind the problem.
Right.
In other words, and the progress. I'd like to maintain hope and say the progress that we made with Title IX, how many young women now play sports, and they don't just sit around cheer for boys, and it gives them a life of their own. That's terrific progress that we've made.
Right.
And so it's a sign of hope.
One of the things you talked about, kind of the waves of feminism.
Yeah.
First wave being Susan B. Anthony and the suffragette movement. You did also incorporate Dorothy Day, the great Catholic leader. And then the second wave with Gloria Steinem and Betty Friedan for the feminine mystique. And then you did talk about Title IX. And then the third one was Madonna and the vagina monocles. Back to Title IX before we go further.
Yeah.
So my experience, as you mentioned, as a basketball player at a college level, University of Toledo, 1979-83, and we had a really high-powered program. And for us as a men's program, we had the prime court time all the time, 2 to 5. And the women were on the other side of the curtain practicing in a obviously less than ideal. And it never dawned on any of us, like, maybe the women should get the prime time and we take it. Was never considered.
Never dawned on you. That's the great phrase.
Yeah, it's embarrassing to say that now. Yeah. And my wife, Laura, who played field hockey at University of Toledo, limited budget. They were driving in broken down, in shaky vans.
Right.
The University of Toledo at times, we were flying in corporate jets to games.
Right.
So that's 40 years ago. So yes, there's progress, but it's even cringeworthy for me to even describe that.
Yeah.
And then there's also, just this last year, speaking of basketball, the March Madness, when Sedona Prince, the really talented basketball player in Oregon, did the video and contrasted the men's weight room versus the women's.
Right.
And that was 2021, and it was amazing that decision makers didn't see that as a problem. So there's all kinds of leadership things with that.
Right.
So with all that great hope, there's always these great falls from prominence that gives us an opportunity to get better.
I like your phrase, though, of raising consciousness. I mean, part of what we're about is to try to see the problem and to recognize our own complicity in it. I know I talked about white fragility and how hard it is for us men often to see our bias, and how we often need women to help us to overcome that bias. I remember the great Catholic feminist theologian Rosemary Ruther, who died recently. I remember being in a discussion with her, just a small group, and I opined, well, she's a biological mother, and I said, well, it must be a wonderful experience to give birth to a child, and what a deep religious experience that might be. And Rosemary looked at me and said, bullshit. And it was an eye-opening thing. It was like Rosemary's and we talked about it.
You had a romantic notion of childbirth.
Yeah, well, not only that, but she said, you're not going to tell me what it's like to give birth to a child.
Yes.
I will tell you what it's like.
Yeah,
and so often in the dialogue with women, it's important to listen and to see it from their perspective and not impose our own perspective on their experience. Rosemary was essentially right. You're not going to tell me about my religious experience. I will tell you.
I'll tell you.
Yeah.
One thing, back to Sedona Prince, at the end of her video when she showed the contrast, it was only a 30-second video, she said, if this doesn't make you angry, this problem doesn't make you angry, then you're part of the problem. Yeah. It was a really challenging.
Powerful.
That's powerful. But yeah. It talks about perspective, right?
At your alma mater, where you played basketball and where I ministered for so many years, they've done an excellent job, by the way, of evening things up between men and women, facility-wise,
right.
budget-wise, and so on. They've made great progress.
Right. The one that the Madonna, the so the, there was the waves were flowing kind of historically, and then you chose Madonna and the Vagina Monocles.
Monologues, yeah.
To kind of talk about feminism in a different way.
Yeah. Well, let's go back a little historically and set the stage for that in those waves. You know, Susan B. Anthony was a major part of that early thing.
Yeah.
And one of the great stories is how she voted in the, I think it was in 1876, voted in the election. She went to a local barber shop where they registered people.
Right.
And she and some of her friends, and they registered. And they actually went and voted. And then she was arrested for it. And she went to trial and was fined and all that. And by the end of her life, in around 1900, she was invited into the White House to talk. And she also had a coin made in her image, Susan B. Anthony. So that progress that women have made, when I taught young women at the collegiate level, I always tried to stress to them how they stood on the shoulders of great people. I mean, they got Title IX, but they have it because of Susan B. Anthony and Elizabeth Cady Stanton and the women who went before. And in that second wave, let's talk about Gloria Steinem. She was from Toledo, Ohio, went to Wade High School, and you know, was prominent. One of her great statements I love, women need men like fish need a bicycle. You know, and so she didn't get married till late in her life, and she was abrasive in many ways and pushing and so on at the edges of all of this. But then the Madonna thing is, as I understand it, some women liked her for a while because she owned her sexuality. She wasn't hiding it. In fact, she was blatantly showing it forth. And a lot of women liked that because they thought it was more honest and more celebrating the distinctive female sexuality. Yeah. I think a lot of people had trouble accepting that. And I know some of the feminists turned against Madonna after a while. And I remember the Vagina Monologues they had at some Catholic schools, and there was a lot of controversy about it. The language is very explicit,
right.
And women are talking, again, freely about their sexuality. I often link that with the Bible. You know, we're talking about the Bible, and it's interesting. In the Song of Songs, a great love poem in the Hebrew Scriptures, and the male and female are talking, and the woman in the story, in this patriarchal culture, unbelievable, she expresses her sexual fantasies first. My lover is like a young stag bounding over the hills. That's just remarkable.
Right.
It's the kind of thing that the feminists do, looking at the scriptures, to try to unpack something that can help them in their cause.
Right.
So the woman, you know, she's a prologue to the Vagina Monologues. She expresses her sexual fantasies, a young stag bounding over the hills.
I took that also that you were challenged this idea that most of society, or traditionally, it's been about the men's sexual experience.
Of course, yeah.
And so the Vagina Monologues turns the table on
that. Yes, for sure, yeah.
Do you think there's a possible fourth wave, Father Basic, with the whole Me Too movement?
Yeah.
And the courageous women that came out publicly against some very strong, very powerful men.
Yeah.
Harvey Weinstein, Matt Lauer, Bill Cosby, Larry Nassar, under great peril to their own well-being, and
yep.
they came forward. Is that another bridging aspect.
Yes, I think it's so important, and you hit it right. Those women were so courageous. I mean, it's so hard to come forward, and they did that and prevailed. And, you know, hearing those women's experience, a number of the collegian women that I dealt with were abused in various ways. Mm-hmm. Sometimes they were taken advantage of, the grad students especially, by the professors, and hit upon. And some went through the whole date rape thing. I remember one collegiate woman, I mean, the stories about Bill Cosby are that he drugged the women, yeah, right, and took advantage of them. And I sat and listened to young women who were drugged and didn't even remember what had happened, yeah, but they knew they had been taken advantage of, often by someone they knew, usually by somebody they knew. So, yeah, I think that that's heightened our consciousness. I was thinking, there was this nurse that I saw often at a doctor's office, and every time we parted, I was so grateful for her kindness and compassion to me over and over, and I would always give her a hug. And I seemed natural. It's what I did. Right. And then the Me Too thing came out, and I said, oh, my heavens, maybe this is out of line. And I remember stopping and asking her, I said, has that been offensive to you? Well, she got me off the hook. You know, said, no, that's so fine. And in fact, if you stop doing it, it'll bother me.
Right.
But
the point being that we as men shouldn't assume that women want us to touch us even in a non-threatening a hug.
Exactly.
Or,
you know. I think behaviors change. I think for all the collegiate women I dealt with all those years, it was common for me to, after Mass, to give them a hug on the way out. And I think priests today need to be more careful of all of that.
Right.
You know, I thought nothing of it, or it felt genuine to me. So I think today you have to be more careful.
Yeah. You know, Tarana Burke is kind of the founder of the Me Too movement. And Laura and I heard her speak at Bowling Green State University a couple of years ago, and she was spellbinding, and it was packed, college student staff, and in the front row was the president, Dr. Rodney Rogers. And Tarana Burke turned to him somewhere during that conversation and started talking to him about things that he could do as president to make things make women safe, understanding gender and sexual violence. It was really powerful. And she did it in a way that was instructive and not, and Dr. Rogers was nodding his head. And it was a very powerful
moment.
Because decision makers obviously have a big role and making sure the organizations are safe and respectful and equitable.
I think from our viewpoint, we have to try to stay open to the whatever way the women want to challenge us.
Yeah.
They might want to be like Rosemary Ruth, or, you know, it's a bunch of baloney you're talking.
Right.
Or the ones who are good at it and since bring us along. That's that book, you know, on fragility.
We like to be brought along gently, but sometimes we need to get hit over the head, right?
I appreciate Rosemary and her comments. But we got to make sure we get in here this biblical thing, you know, the Christian perspective. So what I think is that there are strengths within the Christian tradition that can help us with this. We got a lot of negatives. You know, and we got to admit it. The Bible is a biased book. It's written by all men and so on, you know. But there's stuff in there. There's stuff in there that can help us. There's a friend of mine, Barbara Reed, Dominican sister, who has edited a 58-volume work on a feminist reading of the Scriptures. So that going back and slanting the stories so they favor women. Mm. Like, for example, in the second creation account in Genesis, man is looking for a suitable partner and he can't find one, and then God takes the rib out and makes a woman, and the story is, well, women are subordinate to men. They're taken from men's body, their rib and so on. And Barbara Reed turns the story around and says, no, here's the way to look at this story, that God, Adam couldn't find a suitable partner. He needed somebody who really could interact with him and so on. And so God sort of kept experimenting, found something better and better, and then found this perfect, wonderful, suitable partner, a woman, so that the woman becomes, instead of subordinate to the man in the story, she now is seen as the epitome of God's creation. She can now be this true partner to the man. I love the word that, go ahead,
In the other side of it, and you spent most of your lecture talking in the Lydia mode. Because you covered the waves in there.
The Lydia story was designed to show all the ways that she encountered sexism in her life, right?
And then you went, you spent a little bit of time with Samson, and really it was just a kind of a Marlboro Man father. And the takeaway was that we as men need to be able to understand that we need to connect with people. And be in touch with maybe our feminine side, and we need to be able to relate. And
Very important to bring the male into the picture. The great philosopher Hegel wrote an important thing on the master-slave relationship, in which he says the master suffers as much as the slave. The dominant person suffers as much as the one person oppressed. And so that in a patriarchal society, men are hurt as well as women. In this society where women are 20% of this and that, men are 80%, but it also often inhibits us. Maybe, how many men have a trouble expressing their feelings, how many men have trouble trying to learn from what women are saying. So we end up being diminished if we are not interacting properly with women. And so what you're looking for is relationships of mutuality, looking for relationships where there's an honest give and take, looking for marriages where there's a true partnership, where each brings their own insights, their own strengths, and their own weaknesses to the relationship, and they meld together. So I think it's the good marriages I see that model for me how men and women ought to relate.
Let's talk two we can touch upon. We can spend a long time on these two. The gender divide in the church. Obviously, progress is made. Pope Francis is naming women to leadership roles in the Vatican. There's administrators at the parish level, females that are running parishes. So obviously progress, but how do we deal with that divide?
That's a tough one. We don't have a great history. We don't have a great history. And I always say the Brooklyn Dodgers integrated in 1947 with Jackie Robinson before Catholic churches integrated. We've been behind. Women do better in the corporate world, rising up the ladder, than they do in the church. But a good point you made, though, women are so important at the parish level. Parishes survive because of women, because of their insights, their creativity, their use of their skills to further parishes, and as pastoral administrators, as all kinds of important jobs, religious educators, and so on. But we clearly have a ways to go. You mentioned Pope Francis. Pope Francis is terrific in so many ways. I love him. He's been good for our church. He's been good for the world. But his outlook on women is not all that helpful. Some woman says sometimes he sounds like a 80-year-old Latin American male, which of course he is. And he has had trouble rising above that. But I give him credit. He's appointed women to positions and so on. But when he talks about, I know one woman theologian, Lisa Cahill, great moral theologian, said, he's so good on many other things, I want to give him a pass on his attitude towards women. So he's made some progress. But there is a fundamental problem in our Catholic tradition and history, and that is, it's a theory of gender complementarity. Mm-hmm. This gets difficult to understand, but there's a strong strain in the theological world and in the higher leadership that still sees men as the active players in the public arena, and women primarily as taking care of the home, the domestic things. Mm-hmm. And I would say any attempt to deal with the male-female that reduces women's opportunity in the public sphere is wrong.
Right.
That can't be. No, thank goodness we now have a female vice president. We still don't have a female president in the United States, and we don't have any female priests or bishops or popes, that matter.
Right.
No, so we have to, at a fundamental level, have to move beyond this idea of gender complementarity, that that men are essentially active and women essentially passive. The act of intercourse being, saying how the whole of reality, male-female relationships are to function. There's a fundamental flaw, I think, in that. And we got to get beyond that.
And instructive for us who are married husbands and how they view their wives and how we support them in their pursuits and interests and who they are as a person.
Yeah, and that their distinctive talents. I mean, it could be in many marriages I see them work because the woman is the strongest one, the active one, makes the most money.
Right.
And has the best career and so on.
Right. This is stolen from the headlines, and it's obviously the Dobbs decision, the Supreme Court. How does that... It seems like it just throws a Molotov cocktail into this idea of bridging the male-female divide.
Again, you can see it positively or negatively. Positively, it opens up the possibility of greater efforts to support women, pregnant women, to bring their children to term, to have programs, state programs, federal programs that support pregnant women and even their child. It's interesting, the question is now, for those of us who are pro-life, will there be a complementary effort to support women? Will we support legislation that gives a family leave from the job, gives them time, that will help them? Most of the abortions occur for financial reasons. So it's going to be, will the states do that? And will the church, will the American bishops, be in the forefront of improving the lot of pregnant women, health care for them, care for the poor children, and so on? Yeah, it's opened up again. My idea is always optimism,
Right.
It's opened up an opportunity for pro-life people to be in the forefront of helping women.
Right. Last question. Who are the women in your life that shaped your view of gender?
Yeah, good question. Clearly my mother. I love the stories of my mother. I think in their family, she had a bunch of brothers and a few sisters and so on, and they got a car, which they called a machine, and the boys drove the car around, and she wasn't allowed to do it, so she got the keys, fired up the engine, and off she went driving around. My mother was strong that way, independent, and had her own ideas. So clearly my mother was really important. I've had wonderful female friends who are very accomplished people who have done great work in social justice. I've had a lifelong friend, Sister Patricia Schnapp, went to first grade with her and been with her. She unfortunately has had a stroke and is not all that active now, but I've throughout she's been good. And I think I was studying in New York in the 60s, in the late 60s, and the feminist, and I made was friends with a lumber of very smart, very well educated, and very strong feminist women, and they didn't get me let me get away with language that was not proper, and I was often guilty of using the wrong language. So, and they were good friends, but they were strong and no nonsense. And if you said something that was derogatory to women that you didn't realize, you soon found out.
Right.
You don't talk like that.
Yeah.
So those women were very influential on me. And of course, I mentioned Rosemary Ruther, who was influential as well. And now more, and I'm in my elder years, my two sisters, Barbara and Pat, are very good for me that way. They are wonderful women. They're kind, compassionate. I'm so proud of them, that they live their Catholic heritage, that they see the best of that heritage, that they understand how that Catholic world helps them to live and grow and develop and has helped them to make good marriages and so on. So my two sisters are now a big influence on my life.
Yeah. Well, Father Basic, thank you for the thought-provoking discussion and also the points and themes you raised in your lecture. And may both of us and everyone that listened here, especially on the male side, strive to be more aware of the gender equity and equality and respect and understanding. It's been great. Thank you.
Thanks, Brad.